In one of our trips from Salisbury, I remember so clearly, took us from Salisbury down towards Winchester and then along the south coast. And that was my first glimpse of the South Downs landscape. It was quite remarkable. Because I don't know about you, but you go to some places and you can be left cold by it. You think, well, I don't quite fancy this. But when I came to South Downs, I thought, my God, I like this place. There's something about this place I really like. And that's before I got to see the archaeology. You know, so that was just in a Land Rover, Mark Corney saying to me, oh, that's such and such a site there. That's a site you may have heard of called the Trundle. The Trundle up there? And so we just drove around and we went to have a look at a few sites. And I was really just, I felt immediately at home. It was really, really quite something. It doesn't happen too often, but when it does happen, it's just great.
It's not a dramatic landscape, is it? It's not mountainous, it's not wild. But I think it gets inside your soul, doesn't it? And as I say, friends from other parts of the country who come down, they can see why the South Downs is such a special landscape. It's that quintessential English landscape, isn't it? That just, you know, gets into you, really. Very difficult to pinpoint a particular word, but it can just get into your soul.
All throughout the period that we cover in the past, wood was really, really important. And we are convinced that woodlands were something to be farmed and managed. And we believe that people from a very early time have managed woodlands really, really successfully. Because woodland, it's another growing commodity. It's another growing item that you can use. And it is very, very useful. I mean, we use a lot of wood here. We use it for our buildings. Our houses have wood posts. Our houses have wattle and daub on the walls, most of them, and the wattle is the wood, it's woven hazel, so you'd need to coppice your hazel to ensure that you have thin enough and straight enough branches to be able to use for that. So that was happening at a very early stage, so people understood that if you cut your hazel down and managed it, you could control how that wood was regrowing back. You could make sure that it was the right sort of thickness, the right height, the right elasticity in the wood, so it's really, really important. And we don't just use it for building, we use it for all our fences. It would have been used for tools, it would have been used as handles, it would have been used as spears. You can make it into baskets. Coracles, we make coracles here as a boat for fishing. So lots and lots of things were reliant on wood. It was really a main crop, if you like. It was a main commodity that people managed, apart from the fact that the woodland will support so much livestock as well. So that in itself was important. The wild boar like woodland as shelter. Your pigs, if you kept pigs, you would keep them in woodland because it would support that. It would shelter them from hot weather. It would support them in cold weather, and they would forage for their food. So woodland, and that's apart from the wild life, deer and things that would also stay in the woods. So woodland was really, really important. And we believe that really quite a long way back, people were managing their woodlands not just to support to give them hazel that was coppiced, but also to manage the larger pieces of wood. So I actually think that people were planning a long time in advance and pegging branches from trees down so that those branches would grow the right shape. So if you were looking to replace your plough, which was a fairly sturdy piece of wood, would be a branch, possibly oak, but you'd want it to grow in a particular way. You'd want it to grow the curved shape of a plough. Well, you could peg that down, and over a period of years, that would grow the right shape if you managed it. And we think that people were managing their woodland like that from a long, long time ago. So woodlands were particularly important.
The park has a boundary wall around it, and the main of the chute, probably 80%, 90% of it is within the wall. So it's, yeah. So we never shoot from what we call game covers, artificial covers. We don't plant crops for the game. It's all traditionally driven out of woodland. So the woodland is managed. We have foresters on the estate. It's managed, obviously, the woodland is managed as a commercial venture. It needs to make money at the end of the day, but Also, we work together, the gamekeepers and the foresters and the Duke of Norfolk, we all work together to try and better woodland, for making it better for game and for all wildlife in general. If you've got a good managed estate, you've got not only game, you've got all the other birds and wildlife and flora, wildflowers, all this sort of thing all comes with management. It doesn't happen on its own. It's got to be looked after.
The plantations that I planted were mixtures, because one of the problems with the forester has is to think 100 years in the future. So we looked at not a specific management plan. We wanted a mixture so that whoever came after me could manage it whichever way the market tended. So we planted softwood and various hardwood. We planted oak in a mixture with ash, the oak being the long term, the ash being the short term, and we're in three rows, so we had two rows of ash, one row of ash and oak, and then three rows of softwood. So the softwood could be harvested fairly quickly, hopefully, and produce an income. The ash, slightly longer term, and the oak for the future. You're going to think 200 years ahead.
I think it's a very optimistic future, actually. I'm optimistic because there's such an interest generally in woodland management and what woods mean to society. So many woods aren't managed, though. Historically, the markets have been very weak. But with the interest in wood as a building material, its credentials compared to steel and concrete, I think it has a very good future. And we know that well-managed woods add a lot of value back to society. But it feels hard sometimes to complete the circle, to enable owners. You know, it costs money to manage woodlands properly. And the timber income, rarely, once in a while, it gives you a nice bit of income. But actually, the ongoing management of woodlands is a cost, and the cost is borne by one individual. But society, there's a benefit to society as a whole.
All of these habitats have to be managed. I have interesting discussions with my friends sometimes about nature reserve management, and people see nature reserves, or just the South Downs, or anywhere really, that's not a town or a city, as wild places, and we should just let nature do its thing. Nature will, figure out what to do. It's not really the case, because we've intervened and changed those processes. So if we just let nature take its course now, we would lose what's really important about these habitats and the species associated with them. And that's because we've removed all the natural predators, we've removed all the natural grazers and herbivores. So what we're trying to do with reserve management is replicate those processes which we've destroyed or ruined or diminished. So lack of management would be a real threat to the reserve, and that's just down to resourcing. If we don't have the staff or the volunteers or the money for contractors, or then we can't do the work, and then we lose the grasslands. The grassland has to be grazed or mowed. If we can't do that, then we lose the grasslands. The woodland has to be managed. If we don't do that, we end up with an even age structure canopy, or even worse, we end up with no natural regen because of the fallow deer, so we don't get any new woodland growing. Those trees that exist are beyond where the deer can damage them or eat them, apart from ring barking them, but they can't nip the tops off, so the trees can grow if they're beyond that browsing height. But eventually those trees will reach their natural lifespan and die, and if they're not able to regenerate through their life, then we end up with no woodland. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to replicate what would have been a natural habitat by reserve management. So whether that's grazing or mowing or fencing bits out or managing the deer or all of those things are all trying to produce what would have been what would have been the habitat before we changed it.
We know that they would have cleared woodland to be able to have larger open areas so you can keep your animals. And right back to the Neolithic, we are fairly certain that actually the Neolithic time was the most exciting time, in that people would cut down trees and cut down the undergrowth to allow grass to grow, which would encourage animals to come to the grass. So instead of being hunter-gatherers, people could attract animals to come to them, so you didn't have to go out and hunt them. And once you'd attracted them, you could then, well, I could put a fence around this bit of grass, and that became their first field. And this is the beginnings of farming. And so people understood that, yes, there's a use for trees, yes, trees are important, but actually you can use that area for other things. And now we see that farmers have even taken scrubbed out fence hedge lines to make their fields bigger, but they haven't really come to grips with the fact that actually you might be creating a dust bowl and a very large area. They're doing it for economy of scale, and I think in some farmers they're thinking, well, actually perhaps this wasn't the right thing to do. We do still need the protection, and the hedge will support so much other wildlife as well that is beneficial to the farm.
In the early days, that they had a herd of cows here, Guernseys. So the rotation of the fields, so you'd have a rotation system where you'd have grassland down for maybe 2 or 3 years, and then cattle, sometimes store sheep, you know, which you would have turnips or swedes grown. And then they would, obviously, then that would be ploughed in, and you've got a lot of what they call green manure being ploughed back into the soil, to bring up the goodness of the soil, really, and soil structure. So lots of muck and lots of animal rotation. In those days, it was probably on the downs, it's unheard of to have just a crop growing farm, you know, cereal growing. You would have a rotation where you have animals and then crops. So most farms were like that, you know, to get the body of into the soil, really.
Yeah. You get a job in harvest, in the harvest fields with the threshing and the cutting of the corn. You got a chance to catch a rabbit, so help the food aid at home. You used to get 2 and 6 of that for a week. And they used to, if you didn't have any work harvesting or anything, they used to send you thistle dashing. You used to go through the fields cutting all the thistles down. And they used to pay you for that. That was a sort of old potato picking. There was another backache. Joe used to get a week off school for that during the war, and rosehip picking. But your potato picking was the thing. That was good money.
I mean, I finished at school at 14, and you were thrown straight into that mill. You worked from half past 7 to 6. And up past 7 to 1 o'clock on Saturday. So worked 10 to 50 hours a week. And for a kid of 14 to work 50 hours a week, it wasn't right. But anyway, it built me up to physically, although I was pretty small, but it was an experience that you never forget. And you've got to start life somewhere anyway. Whichever way, and it was cruel sometimes. We used to cut wagon bottoms, railway sleepers, all the stuff that went down the mines, because the mines, as you could imagine, at that time were going great guns. So everything was on the boom. All the furniture, timber, because Singleton Railway was running then. And we used to take it down and load it on the railway. You had to load the railway truck. It all went up to High Wycombe in Buckinghamshire. But there was dozens of other markets, I was saying. It's just mining timber. It's amazing what they did. They used to cut brush backs in, because all the brushes were wooden. And there was thousands and thousands of brush backs they used to get. And they all ought to be stacked in a fan, a special shed. But you can't imagine it today, can you?
No, I left school and went to work at the sawmills as a yard labourer, which was quite hard work because there was no cranes or anything in those days. And the foreman who was a Scotsman, was quite hard. He was tough, but he was hard. He was strong. And we got all the jobs of shifting timber around and loading lorries. And one of the things that really sticks in my mind was loading 16, 18 foot long oak and elm poles, 12 by 12s, which were used for posts for level crossing gates. And the foreman was always impatient. He couldn't wait for the cranes to come and load the lorry. So we'd start off all right, loading on a flatbed lorry, just lifting up. Me and another lad by the name of Cocker Poxley, we were the two labourers. And we'd start off all right, where you do the first layer, and then you go up another foot, and they were getting heavy. And we couldn't manage the third foot. And the foreman used to get really annoyed, but he didn't expect you to do anything he wouldn't do himself. So he used to get us to say, he used to say to us, lift it on my wee backy boy and you'll be all right. So we two of us used to struggle to put it on his shoulder and he used to hook it onto the lorry and then we slid it in position. And that's how I started my life in the sawmill. And from then I became a bit more experienced and I got to work on the end of a saw bench where you took all the waste off and stacked the good through the waste away. And I worked there until just before I went in the army to do my national service.
I would say that my father was more of a forester than I am, although I was brought up to it, and he taught me to drive a tractor when I was about 10 years old. Not for fun, but he thought, well, any idiot can drive a tractor. He was cutting the ash poles and he only showed you once, this is what you do, this is how you put the chain on, right, off you go. And that was it. Of course it was fun, and I loved it. And I worked with the forester down there, Mr. Repton, sometimes on, you know, and I worked in the nursery down there. But that was my initiation into forestry at quite a young age. In fact, I think probably younger than that, my father used to take me sometimes to work with him, whether he was babysitting, I suppose, I don't know. And I remember on one specific occasion that he'd sat me down with his dinner bag underneath a tree and having nothing better to do, I started to peel the bark off. So I managed to peel the bark off all the way around the tree, of course. Father went mad when he said, I've got to cut this down now, it's not supposed to come down. But that was my initiation in forestry. I don't know how old I was, about 4 years old or something.
When we first started, the chainsaws were much heavier and slower, and all the timber you cut, you used to have to handle by yourself. There's no machinery. You load on the tractor and trailer, remove from the woods, and put it in big piles, and then you had to load it on the lorry to go to the mills. Well, now everything's more mechanised. You've got machinery to get the wood out. The chainsaws are a lot lighter, much more efficient, faster. So it makes the job much easier.
I know that the ladies who taught my mentor during my apprenticeship, they were called Peggy and Hilda. I don't know their second names, but Alan's adamant that women were quite involved with certainly some elements of forestry and coppicing. They were made spars, all sorts of things, and he passed their hand tools on to me. So there are women in the industry, but I suppose there are less than men, yeah. I don't want to sound too like I'm on my high horse, but I think that you do have to prove yourself a little bit, and people don't always necessarily think you're going to stick to it. They think you're just going to have a go at it for a while and maybe tail off and then not bother with it anymore. But I'm certainly adamant that this is what I'm going to stick with. And I think that apprenticeships, you know, they're often geared towards people who are school leavers, which is great. But when you're young, you don't really know how your life's going to go. So it can be a bit early on to make that commitment into a certain industry. And I do know of a case where an apprentice, you know, was lots of time and effort was and funding was put into that person, but they were far too young to stick at it. So they ended up, I think they're still in woodland work, but not necessarily coppicing. So maybe it gave him the footing he needed, but he wasn't sure enough at the time. So I think maybe it helps to come to it a bit later in life sometimes. because you know why you're doing it and that you want to do it full term, you know. It's happened on a number of occasions where, say, at a show or even on a job I've got, people will assume that my partner, John, it's his business. So, say we're at a show or something, they'll start asking him questions about the panel work that I've made or, you know, how's this done? And he has to explain to them that actually he doesn't really know, it's me that they need to speak to me instead. And then, you know, often they are very surprised and they say, really, have you made this? And I say, yes, I have. They go, oh my goodness, you're a clever girl. So it does happen that people make the assumption, I think if there's a man there, that you're just the helper and he's the one who is in charge kind of thing and has all the ideas and does all the lifting. So it's good to challenge those preconceptions.
When I first started keepering, Woodland was managed, everything was done by hand. Traditional coppicing was happening. The hazel was always coppiced in a cycle of about 9 to 10 years. When the hazel was cut, it was used for hurdle making, spar making for thatching, and even I can remember, and my father was telling me about, he used to make bunts, hazel bunts for the local bakery, because that was what they used for fuel to put in their bread ovens, which was a bundle of hazel sticks put into the bread oven to heat it, and then the ashes scraped out and the bread put in there, or the dough put in there to make bread. So the hazel was coppiced, and what happens when you coppice hazel, you let the sunlight in. Normally a traditional hazel woodland would be hazel under an oak canopy. So the hazel would be coppiced, let the light in, suddenly you would get everything growing, the seed bank would be there, the foxgloves, the primroses, all the orchids would suddenly grow, sunlight coming through, and then after 10 years or so it would all happen again. The hazel would grow up, the light would shut out, and then you would coppice again.
One thing that's forgotten in this is the poor coppice worker, and there tends to be a lot of people trying to do their very best but actually getting very, very poor return from coppice materials, most of which is down to coppices generally falling into complete lack of management over the last 30, 40, 50 years, where it's been more economical for people to use oil-based products or steel-based products or whatever. And these woods have been kind of forgotten. Trying to make a first cut into a derelict coppice, basically you end up with an awful lot of rubbish that is only good for burning material, whether that be through charcoal, whether it be through just logs. A lot of it, unfortunately, is bonfired. But the second cut and the third cut, which are probably 7 years apart, you actually start getting decent quality material that's then usable by people making fence panels, people, you know, for bean sticks, that sort of product. But of course, for the poor coppice worker, that's a very long time scale.
For a while, I sat with it was the Wessex Coppice Group, and then it became the Hampshire Coppice Group. But there is a Surrey and Sussex Coppice Group still running, and very much promotion within that. I know they are running on a very small scale apprenticeship courses to train people in coppice work. I mean, it's a very skillful job. The problem is the remuneration. It's probably easier to, unless you really want to work in the countryside in all weathers and have that contact with nature, then you can earn far more money just by doing some very mundane job with no skills attached in a town. So there is a problem. Hopefully, if the worldwide energy situation continues, then that can become more valuable. So it's not just firewood. If those coppice workers can continue to do some of those things which are still in demand, producing hurdles, thatching spars, I don't know. I'm not a thatcher, but I understand something like 10,000 thatching spars are needed to thatch a reasonable size house. Well, that's an ongoing thing. They've tried plastic, but hazel is still the thing for thatching spars. So that demand is still out there. And if you speak to the coppice workers who've always been in the trade, they say there's more demand than they can supply. And I do think that situation will continue. If firewood can become the bulk market, which will give them a better income, then the prospect is really good.
Really, we're just the little guys, but we're quite important in our own way, because coppicing is one of the best ways of increasing the biodiversity of the woodland. It's probably one of the most sustainable methods that there is. So it's great for nature and, you know, plant life and wildlife. Whereas some forestry techniques like clear fell are really not the best. Because with coppicing you have different stages of growth. So there's always some cover and you let the light back into the forest floor, which is important. So it feels like it's a worthwhile thing to do for many reasons.
Well, I think a lot of it was planted after the war. They cut a lot of the big trees for the war, during the war. And you've got sweet chestnut, as I say, for the farmer's fence post, when they used to have dairy herds on every farm. You've got the big beech, ash, and sycamore and that sort of trees for the firewood, for the logs. So I don't think they've thought about what they're doing. They just planted what they needed to plant.
Goodwood were quite well known for its beech forests. Well, not so much for the timber, although the timber, they had a huge amount of timber, obviously, you know. But it was the beauty of the beech forest that... And, of course, the beech had lost its value. The furniture industry was changing. Lots and lots of beech went to beech furniture. Well, people had stopped having beech furniture. So it lost its market, really. And where West St Midas used to do mainly all beech, they stopped cutting beech altogether. In fact, they were virtually only cutting oak, and a lot of that was imported, but they probably wouldn't see a beech tree in there, whereas their yard originally would have been loaded up with beech.
Beech, ash, sycamore, some field maple in there. A lot of sycamore in there now where that's crept into the woods. It still burns well enough though, and it splits well, it's good to handle. We sometimes move a bit of chestnut, but that we can only use for, if we don't use it for fencing, we can use it for wood burners. We can't use it for open fires because it spits like mad. But that was mostly the main trees we have.
We had to mark trees for thinning out so that trees could expand, that sort of thing. And then there was nursery work, which meant, you know, growing the trees from seed, acorns, beech, you know, all that sort of thing. And so it was... We've had a lot of variations of trees, but walnut trees were the worst, because if you grow a walnut tree in a nursery, the roots have a habit of spreading out, and there's no way you can, when they've been in the ground 2 years, you have to cut the roots to get it out. But they all seem to survive, you know, because walnut's a very valuable tree.
I've got one or two places in these woods where two different species have grown together. I mean, they're separate plants, but they've grown in together, and they're so close together, and I won't see them. I won't take one away from the other, and I'll just leave them, and I'll just look at them. So it's lovely to look at. It really is, and you see them together like that. It sounds silly, but it's not. It's just a magic thing. That's what it is. And I've got a piece of... which I brought back from one of the woods, a piece of ash that's about 2-3 foot in diameter, and through the middle of it is a yew branch that's grown virtually through it. It isn't actually right through it. The tree grew, the ash grew round the, but it looks on one side, it looks as if the two are grown together. It's just brilliant to look at.
We specialise in English woods. It's a bit of a giveaway in the name of the company, and it would be a bit strange to be called English wood and this timber and not specialise in English woods. So we buy oak, we buy ash, we buy sweet chestnut, we buy walnut, we buy elm. Those are our main five. Did I say ash? I can't remember. Ash. And those are the five main English species that we mill and are used by the market. Occasionally we'll buy cherry and walnut, yew tree, but they're more minor species, but they have an interesting grain and figure which appeals to many people. There's a huge resurgence in the desirability of wood in houses, for tables, for window frames, for just have it. It's a very tactile material. We try and buy as locally as possible because it's easier on the car and it's nice to deal with local people. But we will go right up, for elm we have to go right up into northern England and Scotland. We often find very figured, burry, pippy oak, which is something that the furniture trade are very keen on. It has a very interesting grain pattern.
Most of it that came out of here was beech. I don't know what they used to use it for. I don't doubt a lot of the rifle butts were beech. So no doubt a lot of it got used for that. I don't know what else it got used for, to be honest. But it used to go down to Charlton sawmills. That's where most of the beech was extracted to. But it was a bit more than just a sawmill. Because I know loads of people used to work there. It used to employ like 200 people, I've heard say at one time. And, you know, from all around. Even my mother used to work down there at one time. She'd stack brush bags, you know, to make brooms and things like that. And they'd machine all the stuff. And somebody had to stack them to dry them. They used to make dowel down there as well. An awful lot of dowel for the furniture trade.
There's quite a big list. Some of them include pea sticks and bean sticks, just for gardeners, which, you know, obviously bamboo is quite popular in most people's gardens, but you know, it seems a bit crazy to me because literally there's so much hazel and chestnut to use that I think everybody should be banned from using bamboo because it's a criminal, you know, it's all on our doorsteps. And loads of people say it's really hard to find pea sticks and bean sticks, you know, proper ones, traditional ones. We also make gads, which are lengths of wood, very straight. And we supply those to spar makers for thatching. Hurdle rods, faggot materials for bakers, riverbank faggots for revetment projects. What else? Well, the list goes on, really, and that's the beauty of coppicing hazel. There's just literally no waste. Every part of the growth gets used for something, and even the big stuff, which is too big to use for anything else, it goes for firewood or charcoal. So at the end of it, you have little piles of tops which are either left for wildlife or you could use it for dead hedging to stop the deer grazing. So there's literally nothing left. And then it all regrows again. So that's the beauty of it.
Years ago, mainly, we used to buy all the hardwood for pulp to go into paper and cardboard. We'd buy softwood for fencing, which we'd sell to mills around the south. But over latter years, we've started making our own fence panels, and we've also started selling logs. So it's, and also fencing stakes for the farmers. So it's pretty well all year round.
Here on the farm, we don't just use wood for our buildings and our fences, but one of the most important things we use wood for is the last use that any piece of wood would have, and that's the fire. And as I keep saying to our visiting school children, imagine what life would be like if man had not invented, not discovered that they could make fires. You know, not having any heating, not being able to cook anything, having to eat all your food raw, not being able to boil any water, not being able to have light when it was dark. all those things, we can be thankful that we know how to light fires. And being able, you've got to have fuel for your fire. So the fence, the wood that we use in our fences, when it's reached its the end of its life as a useful fence, the last thing it's going to be used for is wood for our fire. And that's really, really important. And that's what everything we understand would have had more than one use. People in the past in our country were brilliant recyclers. We are only now coming to grips with the idea that we ought to be recycling more. And we've got a long way to go compared to how people lived in the past on those fronts.
The thing that pops into my head immediately is children's stuff, children's toys, because children grow out of things so quickly. And I know wooden toys exist already, but they did used to exist a lot more than they do now and were more popular. But plastic's just so easy and cheap, I suppose. People have to pay more to get wooden stuff. But if they invested in it and it was passed on to other people once they'd finished with it, then that would be the best way to go. But, you know, you see faded plastic toys in people's gardens and just it's nasty stuff. So maybe that's the first thing I can think of anyway.
I mean, it was terrible, absolutely terrible. I mean, the Duke was very, very supportive, I have to say, because just looking at the park, and the private woodland, it looked just like a bomb had hit it. It was terrible, absolutely awful. Not just trees falling down, but debris everywhere. The whole Goodwood Park was covered in debris. We couldn't get around the estate because all the roads were blocked, and quite a formidable task then, obviously, you know. But the Duke was very, very supportive. He's probably the person that I've admired most and respected most in my life. And he called me into his office and helped me a lot, you know. He said, just take your time. It'll all be cleared up. Don't worry about it. Even though I'm sure he was quite worried himself because, you know, the cost of the damage was enormous, really, you know. But we did, and I suppose it took 5 years to clear most of it and 10 years to clear all of it, you know, in the end. But we set it to rights. In actual fact, we did a lot of work that needed to be done in the park with the major trees, with a lot of tree surgery, and improved it at that time. But it was a formidable task, there's no doubt about that.
Trees were laying everywhere, all the way. We managed to get to the gate, and that was it. We couldn't, because we used to leave our chainsaws here in the olden days, and we had a lot of tree work to do in people's gardens, but we couldn't even get the saws. We had to walk for them and walk back again. So it was a bit of a mess, all the way up the drive, which is probably, what, half a mile from the gate? Possibly. Yeah, we were working up hard for months, clearing up people's gardens and fences. And
just after the storm, we planted in a few places because it was total wipeout, and we planted cherry and we planted some oak and beech. And they seem to have got away. But we had to, when we tubed, we found that cherry was very good, but as soon as it got to the top of the tube, the fallow, being that much bigger, nibbled the tops. So we had to put another half tube on top to get them up further before they could get away. Same with ash, actually. They're taking the top set of ash as well. So we found we've got a half tube again to get them away. Otherwise they do the same thing as if they're on the ground. They just come along each year and browse the tops, and they'll keep them down all the time. But with perseverance, we've got some of it going anyway.
We have many more pests and diseases affecting our tree populations now. You'll be familiar with the Calara affecting ash at the moment. We're seeing a lot of Calara now in the woods around here. There's going to be an enormous quantity. I don't think people really realise it. There's going to be a huge number of trees dying across the country. we're working on a project now to find out, to work out how we can use this timber within the industry. I don't know whether it's going to be as dramatic an effect on the landscape as the elms, but I, you know, over a 10-15 year period, I think it could eat 80 million trees, and a very big proportion of those are going to come crashing down, I'm afraid. So that is going to change our landscape a lot.
There's still quite a few elms about here. Yeah, we had some, we had one or two beauties in just below Park Farm, but they all got it. And there was some at the bottom of the garden here. There was, I can't remember how many there was, but there was a few there. There were several scattered about the southern part of the estate, as I recall. There's one or two salas that stuck out in the fields as well. In fact, there's one field that's named Elm Tree because there was an elm, still a big old elm out there. But what you see in the garden now, in the bottom of the garden, there is that those are young elms. And they, I believe, are still the same root as what the old elm was that was there that got the disease. It seems to me that the root survives and puts out fresh suckers, and they get up so far, and then they get the disease, they die, and then the process goes on. But they can only get, it seems to me, they can only get so high and they get clobbered again, which seems to be the tragedy of it.
Well, of course, we had the beech bark disease, we've had the chestnut, some of these diseases are never recovering from. The beech bark, by the way, was a period when it happened. I don't know whether it was climatic or what it was, but the beech trees used to get a fungus, and then after this happened, they grew round. So when they fell these beech trees in years to come, you know, when they're about that size, the timber will be useless because there's all this disease in the middle. So most of the beech will have to go to firewood.
Springtime and summertime, early winter, we have to do a certain amount of legal predator control, which is we don't try and eliminate predators, we just try and control them so that we've got a balance. Rats, stoats, weasels, foxes, crows, magpies, they're our predominant ones that we control a bit.
You know, grey squirrels have a major impact on things like oak trees, biting off buds in oak trees and things like that. Okay, I know they're trying to survive, but they are causing major problems. You know, you take the buds off an oak tree, it can't grow properly, and it makes it susceptible to diseases. And, you know, that's a major issue.
Natural regeneration in the last 30 years, across the board, all plants, including all trees, are affected by the many, many species of deer, particularly pockets of fallow deer, but many muntjac and roe deer are now across the whole of the southeast. I think there's a little area in Kent where perhaps we haven't got that situation, but in the area we're talking about here, there's an enormous impact on the countryside by deer. So the farmer feels that too. I visited one farmer near, just south of Uppark, some years ago, so that must be 1996, and he was devastated. I was looking at his woodlands, but he walked me into his fields, and there was one section of his field, I think it was a large field, 60 acres, and one third of that corn crop had been eaten off by a herd of fallow deer that moved in overnight. So the impact wasn't just on the woodland, it was on the farmland as well. So quite dramatic.
One of the biggest, I don't know what the word is, destruction machines, if you like, is deer. And there needs to be some major, major deer control. We've demonstrated it on one of the sites that I work with. The first year we didn't do any deer control. every single bit of regrowth on hazel that we were cutting was absolutely shaved. Almost immediately it grew, it got shaved again. As soon as we put deer fencing up, within a month of putting deer fencing up, that regrowth was nearly a foot high. So, you know, it's just amazing, the sheer number of deer that are here. I know a lot of people think, yeah, oh, lovely little Bambi. But unfortunately, lovely little Bambi, in a very short, relatively short time, you know, can produce extra little Bambis. And they really are a serious, serious problem for woodlands generally, and certainly for coppicing. Probably followed fairly closely by grey squirrels.
We employ a stalker, and we call on the reserve, targeting females because that reduces the population size, and obviously following really strict rules and guidance about when we shoot to so that we're not shooting any animals if they've got young or they're pregnant. Shooting adults to reduce the population size so that we can protect the habitats. And obviously we employ someone who's very competent and very skilled, so there's no issues about animal welfare. So and it produces, you know, income that's going back into the South Downs. So it's about local economy, isn't it? He's producing South Downs venison, which is going back into the local economy. So I think it's a good way to do it.
There was two ladies from the village used to always be out with their prams collecting firewood. And I used to turn a blind eye because they weren't doing a lot of harm, really. But one day I was with my boss on the shoot, and we met him head on. And he said, "What on earth's going on here?" I said, "That's all right, sir. They're just getting a bit of firewood." And I never thought any more about it. But a few weeks later, I get a letter from the Cowdrey Estate Office. In future, anybody caught stealing wood will be prosecuted, which I totally ignored. That was that. Obviously, my boss had mentioned it. I mean, it didn't worry him, Colonel Lakin, and he wasn't bothered about it, but he obviously mentioned it to the agent, and the agent wrote to me that letter, which I completely ignored.
I mean, you do have to be careful because you can go into the woods and you can collect dry firewood and you can cut it with a handsaw, but you have to get a licence to do this, to collect dead wood from the Forestry Commission at Slindon. And mm-hmm. I can remember years and years ago, about 30 years ago, I got one. It wasn't very much money, but you had to know somebody else in the village that was in the woods. And as it happened, you know, I was fortunate that being a family that was in the wood, then I could say, "Oh, I know so-and-so, I know so-and-so." And then you're given an allotted area where you can go and collect that dry wood for firewood. But it has to be dead wood. And as I say, you can cut something if it's obviously not one of their trees and take it away.
One morning I was driving past a wood which was right by the road, and there was an old couple up in the wood trying to saw up a huge oak limb with a little bushman, and they were elderly, and their little car parked outside the wood. So I walked up and they looked afraid. They were obviously people that knew they were wrong, or thought they were wrong. And so I said, looked at them, I said, "What are you doing?" "Well, we're only trying to get a bit of firewood, sir." They called me sir. So I went back to my tractor and got my chainsaw and sawed it up for them. "There you are," I said, "that'll save you a lot of time." And that was that.
What I think very few people knew, or indeed know, is that in addition to sort of Dad's Army, the Home Guard, they also had sort of a secret army on the Downs, which involved local farmers. And it was all secret, and there were a series of cells all the way along the potential invasion area in the Second World War, which were manned by a local farmer and some of his people, some of his men. And no one talked about it. It was very, very secret. And John Budden was in charge of one of these. And he showed me the dugout in a woodland area on his land. They dug a fairly large chamber, and it was sort of corrugated iron and timber over and camouflaged and everything. It was in this piece of woodland. It couldn't be seen from the air. They would spend some nights there. They had guns and they had explosives. And if called on, they were the sort of last line of resistance if the Germans landed. Now, presumably, this happened all the way along the Downs. And I'm sure people are researching it or know about it, but John didn't know about anyone else. He only knew about his own little enclave. And it's there as a piece of archaeology. It's all caved in now. But that could be excavated as a piece of archaeology, and you would have the corrugated iron, and you might have some old shells and things in there.
The Royal Engineers put in a bunker for the Uxbridge Uperdo and the secret army business. The people that were supposed to stay behind in case of an invasion. I suppose this sounds like the Crimean War to you, doesn't it? Yeah, we've got one of those in the thicket wood. I forget what they called this out from here. Anyway, they were put in place along the Downs in different places. And I think I've read in the book somewhere, this one was constructed by the Royal Engineers. It's in there, and there's a hole further up in the woods where there's a telephone line put in for it. Just in case we got invaded and these guys were going to stay behind. We suspect we know who one or two of those people might have been, but it was all very secret.
The other things which are there are the guerrilla hideouts, three of them. If there was an invasion, these men who were sort of not all Dad's army, but they were army personnel as well, and they dug these deep pits and in one case lined them with concrete inside, and they are the size of a house underground. And one of them in the yew grove, I remember, had a manhole cover the size of a street drain, and I went down into it, and there's all sorts of equipment in there, electric wires for their field telephones. They'd got water tanks, rainwater draining in. They'd got shelving. There was no food. There were no sort of old tins of baked beans or anything. But there was quite a lot of litter and rubbish. Actually, I filled that one in because health and safety said, oh, that's dangerous, somebody will fall in there. So I went and filled it in. But I know where it is, and one day somebody must go along and dig it out again. Mm. And the other two are open pits, which the Army Bomb Disposal examined with great care in 1990. And there again, there were water tanks. I've got one of them here. And there was half a gun barrel off a tank, which I've got here in the garden, I can show you, and wires and you know, cups and all sorts of stuff like that.
After the war, me and one of my mates at East Dean, we found a hidden hut, office, dug in the ground. It was said bunks to sleep in, kitchen and everything, and we just stumbled on that by accident. So we made that our camp, which was obviously left by the Americans, I suppose. When they left, they just left it, you know.
Yeah, and then sometimes we'd walk up through the woods and go down over Charlton or whatever and see if we could find all the old mortar fins and things like that, because it was a firing range. Well, all up through round here, up in Half Moon, that was a firing range as well. and down Charlton it was quite a big fire and rain down there, and you'd go up and see where they'd ploughed the fields and you'd find all these mortar fins and things like that. We had a lot of Canadians around here. Not Canadians, Canadians, Americans, mostly Canadians around here.
In Sandpit Wood, which is now altered because the gravel pits went through there, but there was a doodle bug came down there and blasted the big hole in there and knocked the ceilings out of the cottages down the bottom. And the wood that they took out of Sandpit Wood, they couldn't use because it's full of shrapnel. But that was the carcass of that doodle bug laid there for years until somebody took it away. So yeah, that was the nearest we got to a direct hit, I think.
So there was around 2,000 Canadian troops stationed on the reserve, and my understanding, or how the story's been told to me, is that when they were told they could go home, the war was over and it was time for them to leave, they were told, you know, deal with all of your ordnance and ammunition stuff, and once you've done that, you can go home. And I guess the choice was either take it down to Portsmouth or the nearest military base and deal with it. It might take, I don't know, hours or days to do, or just bury it in holes in the ground. And that would be very quick, and then you can go home. So you do find these sort of big pits full of ordnance. And also, just because it was a firing range, you find things that have been fired and might not have gone off at the time, or rolled into down the hill into hide themselves in little places for the badgers to dig out later. So it does turn up reasonably regularly, and there's a combination of the smoke bombs and the high explosives, and it's usually the smoke ones that turn up, but the high explosive ones do turn up as well. So we have to treat them all like they're dangerous and deal with it in the proper way.
Life was very different back then, and that's what I find interesting. I think today, the South Downs, there are still pockets of it, but it's a very different affluent area from what it was, as you say, my grandmother growing up, and she was one of four. You know, her father died in the First World War, so she was, her mother, my great-grandmother, brought her up on her own. Life was hard then, and it's having that appreciation that today it's a very, very, although it's beautiful, it's a very affluent area we live in, and how in the past 100 years, you know, the South Downs has changed. And I think it's important to recognise those changes.
One of my jobs was to cook and feed the chicken feed every day, the old potatoes, mash it up, feed the chicken. Go get the well water from the well in a bucket and yolks. Yeah, we were lucky we had a well close by, but when that dried up, we had to go down to the village pub, pump it up. And that's when you use the yolks to bring the buckets of water back. That was one of my jobs. I didn't have to do a lot of gardening because I'm a bit of a dead loss at gardening. My dad did all the gardening. We had a big, big vegetable garden, actually. I don't know how he managed it, but he used to keep it all dug and grow the potatoes and everything. Cut all the grass with a peg. Didn't have a mower or anything. We grew damsons and plums. Yeah, that was another job of mine. After the war, Buns, the greengrocers, and fruiterers in Chaya, was to come in on the bus, first bus in the morning, with baked 4 boxes of damsons, plums, stack them on the bus, get into Chichester at the bus station, and then I used to take them from West Street down to East Street here, to Buns. So I couldn't carry more than one box at a time, so I was running about as a fool. And Dad used to get rid of the plums that way. He used to sell them to Buns, the fruit here.
Before Dad went to work, he used to get 3 buckets of water, so that was 6 gallons, and that would have to last the day. And I can recall in the summer being thirsty and saying, "Mum, I'd like a drink," and she'd say, "Oh, you have to wait till your dad comes home," and waited till Dad came home and then had a drink.
We had a range in the kitchen, which was the heating and the only way of cooking. You cooked on the range, and you had to light the fire before you could boil a kettle for a cup of tea in the morning. And it was always very cold. You only had the one coal fire in the sitting room. And as I say, with the water, we had to go up the top of the garden to the well and wind the bucket down, and then wind it and carry the buckets home. And I can remember we had a rainwater butt outside. My dad used to say, "You girls washing your hair, use that water." And we said, no, it's got insects in it. But he insisted that we use that water. Not, he didn't want to go back up to the well that night if we'd used all the water. Something we take so much for granted now, just turn the tap on and it's there. And as I say, the toilet was over the bridge, over the River Lavant, at the bottom of the garden. My dad used to bury it in the garden somewhere. We were talking about that the other day because I said we never ever saw him do that. When he, I think he must have done it before anybody was up in the morning, or I don't know, but he dug a hole in the garden somewhere and used to empty it and bury it. That's probably why we had such lovely vegetables. I don't think about that.
Well, you get used to what you've got. I think, well, I look back on it now and I think, gosh, how did I have to, how did I do that with, you know, four kids? But, I can. And I, well, even now, actually, because I don't have the electricity, if when I need to do the laundry, I have to go to a laundrette. It's not the same as having a washroom. If I had a washroom, I would use it, but I don't have a washroom. And actually, we started off doing all our own hand washing. But once we had two children, it used so much water. And bearing in mind, when the second child was born, we still didn't have running water then. We were going and gathering our water in tubs and bringing it down. So it wasn't so much the washing of it, it was the rinsing that it just took so much water. It just started getting ridiculous. I was collecting water in 25-gallon tubs, you know, and we'd be filling 15 of them up and they wouldn't be lasting a week. This is crazy. So, the laundry had to stop. We had to start going to the laundrette. But that means I have wash day. You know, I have that one moment where all the laundry's done at the end of a Thursday or whatever it is, whatever day I go. And I get it all done in a day and I come back and then we've got laundry hanging everywhere for a day or two. But because of the stove, it's dry in no time.
Yeah, it's all blimey, even there's a nipper. Well, as I say, I can remember an earth closet. I remember my dad said one time, I don't know how old I was. I must have been about 14, 15. I knew they had dug this out every year and I thought, I might get away with this, you know. Because this was when we bought the place. I remember him buying it from Goodwood, and I must have been about 14, something like that. Well, you're old enough now, you can help. Oh, it's a blooming good job this is. Digging all this out. And then we got it finished, and he says to me, he says, right, well, I suppose we might as well go and do Mrs. Layton's now. I said, Mrs. Layton? Who was our neighbour? He said, well, yeah. He said, well, she can't do it, can she? I said, well, no, I suppose not. Well, come on then. So we had to go and dig hers out there. Yeah. You'd have what we used to call a gutter, and you knew when it was going to happen, so you keep all the grass cuttings to one side, push them to one side, which you'd normally put in this gutter, and then you'd dig out, which would obviously have been last year's, and that would go out on the garden. So then that was empty then, so then you cleared the toilet out, that went in there, and all the grass cuttings that you'd been saving for the last couple of weeks, you put them on the top of it. I remember the nipper being told, don't you go anywhere near there, boy. And you go, well, I ain't likely to. I know what's underneath of it. So those things have changed an awful lot.
Oh, people think I'm spinning them a tail. They say things like, oh, yes, we had a cesspit. And I said, we'd have loved to have had a cesspit. But we didn't have a bucket and chuck it. We had a pit. And that was emptied every year in the spring. And you had to empty it in the spring because that's when there was a fresh vegetation and you were digging the garden. So you'd take out what was in the bottom of the other pit, called the gutter, put it on the garden, and then you'd put what was in the outside loo into the bottom of the pit, and then some of the compost, the top layer of compost that you couldn't put on the garden, hadn't broken down, would be put on top of that. And then it was covered with every bit of grass cutting that you could find to put on top of that. Mm. And then all the other stuff was spread around the garden. And no, we didn't catch anything nasty. And yes, we did have lovely vegetables.
Obviously, a lot of my work is because I have to keep the house fueled. There's I have a wood-burning stove, which is also my oven, which does all my hot water. The hot water's all run by convection, so there's no electricity or pumps or anything. So if I haven't got the wood cut, then we won't have any heating or any form of cooking. We rely on that wood to provide us with the comforts of home, which, I mean, I really appreciate it. For so many years, we had a hip bath, which, like I said before, you know, we heated the water up and it was good enough. We could get clean, but it wasn't, after you've been out in the woods all day and you're really aching and you really want to just soak in the bath. So I really appreciate my bath, but it's, now that I've got one, and the fact that I can just turn a tap and hot water comes out. I mean, it's just, that's like luxury, five-star luxury to me.
I like to think that we try very hard to enthuse people to perhaps look more carefully at the resources they're using, because in our society today, we're not terrifically, we're coming better at it, but we're not very good at making the best use of our resources. We are terrifically wasteful. And if you look back at earlier civilizations, earlier generations that lived in our country, everybody had to be very careful about what they were using, because everything they used, they had to put effort into producing or looking after or hunting or finding or growing, and so they were very careful with all their resources. And I think if we can get that information over to people, if people go away thinking, well, actually, they wouldn't have thrown that jumper away just because it didn't fit anymore, they would pass it on to somebody else. Yeah, actually, if those trousers didn't fit that boy anymore because he'd grown, they would make another piece of material and sew on the trouser legs. Okay, we might not want to go and do that, but it was a way of looking at all the resources and making them, rather than throwing things away. People did not throw things away, very, very rarely. Things were reused. And if something couldn't be used for its original purpose, then there might be another thing that it could be used for, so that it wasn't wasted. And I think that probably is the most important thing that I hope people go away with, and I think people do. Certainly amongst our staff, that is something that is talked about quite a lot. So I think that's something that, particularly in this day and age, I think that's something that's really, really important.
Up at my grandfather's garden, they had a pigsty at the top of the garden, and there used to be a farmer, I won't mention his name, but he used to come to slaughter the pig. And I can remember, when we were, you know how curious you are when you're children. I remember my granny, she was always in the kitchen, always cooking. And I used to have this beautiful scrubbed, great big kitchen table and the range behind her. And she used to make the most beautiful things. And I remember we ran in and there was this glass. It didn't have any water on it, but it was just sitting empty on the corner of the table. Well, it's the wrong place for a glass to be, for one thing. Think, on the corner of a table, how dangerous. And when you come in, and who would want a glass, you know, with nothing in it? And we were told, don't touch it. Run along, they'd say, run along. Well, anyway, we later learned in life that the farmer used to cut the pig's throat, and he used to drink a glass of the blood.
Hot.
It was suggested that it was because it made him virile.
Sorry, I haven't mentioned his name.
I think I've told you about the Christmas party at Goodwood House. A bus used to come and collect all the children in the area. A massive, great big Christmas tree and lovely tea, things that we didn't see very much at home. And going into this great big reception hall with a Christmas tree all lit up and sat on long tables with white cloths on, and we had jelly, which we didn't see, and cakes and different sandwiches, I think. I can't remember, but I know we were gluttons of ourselves. and we were all given a present when we left, which was normally a book or something. I think it was books mostly we had. I think the little ones had a fluffy toy, a soft toy or something.
Yeah, there was a Christmas party for the children. That was, as I remember it, that was done by, I don't remember, when Sir William Byrd had passed on just before I was born. But they used to have the harvest suppers at the big house, and then they moved it to the village hall. But when I was a kid, Leonard Hawkins's wife, she used to organise a Christmas party at the village hall, and all the estate workers' children used to go to there. Yeah, that was good. And somebody, one of the estate workers used to be a Father Christmas and give out a present and stuff like that. And the old cook that was there, that she was Austrian. Miss Valdi, her name was. She used to cook over at the big house at Sallust. And she's a big buxom woman with her hair done up, grey hair she was. And she used to scare the life out of me. I don't know why, but I was so petrified of her. She's a very formidable woman, but she's over there for years and years. And we used to go over there. My father used to take me over there of a Friday morning sometimes, when the Hawkinses were back from South Africa, because they used to go to South Africa because their family was out there. And when they arrived home, we used to have to do, apart from the milk round, we used to have to do cream for them as well. We used to separate cream. And we used to have to take cream up to the big house. And we used to go, and I used to hype it on my dad because I was so scared of her. I don't know why. But anyway, it's just one of those childhood nightmares, I suppose.
Yeah, it was a nice life, really, compared with today's life. You mentioned the woods. We were surrounded by wood, because everywhere there were stacks of timber because of the sawmills. So we used those as play areas. They were dangerous, they could fall over, but they didn't very often.
They knew their trees from quite a young age, and they went on a school trip once, and there were lots of questions about what tree is this, you know, where does this leaf come from? And they were quite small and they knew all the different ones, so they are familiar with being outside and digging and waiting around for me, really, which I think is a good thing. Gets them outside, and they like it, and it keeps them healthy, I think, in their brain. It's good for them to be outside as much as possible, but as they get older, it is tricky to keep them sort of interested in what you're doing.
We used to go up in the woods, in the harvest field during the summer on the farm. We used to go up there with a bottle of water and a jam sandwich. It wasn't bottles, wasn't Coke and crisps and things in those days. And we'd spend all day in the harvest field, come home with sacks of corn on the tractor when it was getting dark. But, I mean, our parents never worried where we were. I mean, you didn't hear all these terrible things. We were in the harvest field and that was that. And we very often came home with a rabbit when they used to catch the rabbits at the end of cutting the cornfield.
But during the time that I was a child, we used to play in the woods, and we used to make camps up High Lane and underneath the great big trees up there, all the yew trees. And we also used to go up New Road, and that was lovely. And we used to do East Dean Woods, and that at that time had just been freshly planted. They'd cleared all the timber after the war, and it was all new planted, and everything was covered in violets and primroses. And when I was very small, round about, I don't think I was at school then, and I wanted to show my friend who lived in the field just up above in a caravan with her brother, Linda and Timothy. And I said, you must come to see the primroses. And we went up over Court Hill and into Scratley, and I was showing them the primroses and the violets, and so exciting. And I heard my mother calling, and I said, oh, I have to go, my mother's calling. And my mum and my brother and other people, actually, they were all looking for us. They were absolutely frantic. Bearing in mind, it was probably about a mile out of the village. The only time I ever got spanked, I think. And the old people next door to us, they said, but we were so worried, we thought we'd have to get the dogs out to look for you.
The barns we used to play in as kids, those sort of wrecks, those, you know, are now converted into, you know, high-class accommodation, which go for over £1 million. Yet, you know, we used to sort of mess around in them for hours or for hours on end by the streams and get soaking wet, or playing on the farm tip. So I remember every Wednesday we used to go across to a friend's swimming pool, but on the way there'd be the farm tip. So we'd be playing amongst sort of empty ICI bags and bottles of pesticides and just jumping around and bits of farm machinery, and never thought about it at all, really. And so long as we came home and were alive, we might have been covered in nitrates or phosphorus or something, it didn't seem to matter. You wouldn't do it today, would you? It's that sort of age of lost innocence. Or have we become too conscious about risk, that all risk must be eliminated? So I think it's to what degree do we still allow for risk? Or playing in stubble, you know, Father used to sort of, you did the stubble burning after harvest, and I just remember as a kid, it was dark, or the sort of glorious dark glow of the late sunsets, and there you'd have, and I know stubble burning is considered environmentally friendly, but it was great fun, you know, so we'd have rows and rows of lines of stubble being burnt, and we'd be jumping over them.
Ah, I'm playing, I'm really puzzled with this question, because quite often they just want it to be a mystery to me, and they will just I've got a few things. There is a trampoline in the woods, but they, you know, they don't use it as much as I thought they would, and there's a bit of a scramble net and things like that, but they mainly it's about just having the freedom to be. But the thing is, the boundaries, a lot of children have to go and play in the garden, and I don't think my kids have got a concept of how much more freedom they've got here, because they still want to go beyond that boundary, which is still a lot further than a lot of kids have got, because, you know, when we started taking Woody to preschool, he asked if we could have a house by the road so that we could have Christmas lights. So they know it's different, but I don't think, and like I say, I think they play better in the woods when there's other children. When it's just them here, it's like, oh, mum's working and we're just kicking about. And that's the sort of routine that they've got into. But I know, you know, in the summer, I won't see them for a couple of hours. I'll be thinking, well, where have they gone? When my friend comes down to visit from Coventry, she said it's a little bit disarming at first, because when you're in Coventry, you need to know where your children are all the time. But they come here and they scatter off to the four corners, and actually you don't know where they are. You don't really know what they're doing. And normally they're doing, if you were watching, you'd probably tell them not to do it. But they have to learn these things, don't they? You know, normally something involving spears and running with sticks, which I've mentioned before, is something that we're always told not to do. But they still do it, because why is the biggest question in a child's head about everything? And they won't be satisfied until they've answered it themselves, really. You could tell them why, but they don't necessarily follow. But I think I'm really puzzled with this question, playing in the woods, because I think they do see it as a workspace as well.
Whenever I buy a log and I saw it, I'm a 10-year-old boy again. And because it's, you know, that obviously made a very profound impression on me at that age. You're uncovering something that hasn't seen the light of day for many decades, if not centuries. And, you know that when that comes, when it's dried and is made into a beautiful piece of furniture, that in itself will last a very, very long time and provide someone with a lot of pleasure.
Just everything, I guess, just the lot. Where we live, I think you'd agree, is probably an excellent place to be. Just nature firsthand, and being a fairly quiet place down here, and knowing that I can go from here and with the landowner's permission either side, I can virtually go wherever I want, you know, it's my backyard. It always has been. I played in these woods and I worked some of them and I worked all the land and worked with the people that were here then. And so to me, it's part of me.
I think you appreciate the countryside more by working in the countryside. Every day you see something new, every day. I still, after 45 years, I still go out in the morning and see something and I come home and tell my wife, God, I saw so-and-so today, or I've seen such-and-such. And you think after 45 years you've seen it all, learnt it all, but you haven't. You still, there's always new things to find out and see.
Oh, you know, it's going to be so hard to leave this place. It's been a bit, yeah, it's been a roller coaster. It's been a challenge. It's been brilliant. I wouldn't take it back, you know, for a minute. It's just a really special site. You know, there's loads of really nice nature reserves around, and obviously I'm completely biased because I work on this one. There's just something really special about this reserve. There's some magic to it. And I don't know whether that's just, you know, the history of the site. You just, even if subconsciously you're kind of picking up on this kind of importance, if, you know, people have valued it for a long, long time. And you know, that's for a reason. There's something about it that's really, really special. Yeah, I think there's been, you know, there's always going to be ups and downs and in any job, on any reserve or in any job anywhere. But it's definitely... it's definitely taught me to try and put things in perspective and take things in my stride. And when someone's, when you're, you know, dealing with difficult things on the reserve or issues, you just have to, I just try to remember that what it's about is about looking after this place to hand it over in a good condition to future generations. And if in 100 or 500 years' time, people are going and standing under those trees or standing on the top of the hill and looking at view and saying, you know, wow, what, you know, tell us about the history from a few hundred years ago. If they've got that site and it's still special, then we've done something right and we've looked after it properly. So that's a really good feeling.
Someone said to me once, forestry is not about trees, it's about people. It's the people in the industry that are really, they're some great characters. And I'm sure everyone within the forest industry, they all, if you dig deep enough, they all have a similar instinct around them. They are, in my experience, they've always been good people. They're earthed, if you like, and it's very enjoyable to work with people that are earthed, and there's nothing fancy about them. Yeah, they're just straightforward people.